This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Lisa Schwartz's novel, The Possible World, starts with a terrible crime. But the book isn't really about that. Hers is a complicated story of how our lives are blown off course by trauma, and whether healing from it requires reinventing ourselves entirely. Lisa knows more about trauma than the average fiction author, as she previously worked as an emergency medicine doctor. Her experiences in the ER led her to ponder some of the questions explored in this book, like who are we and how are we all connected? Author Lisa Schwartz joins me in studio now. Lisa, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me, Anita.
I absolutely loved reading your book. I binge read it last night. And so I want to share the wonder of it with everyone. Take us to the beginning of the novel and help us understand the premise.
Okay. I suppose the beginning is really about Ben, who's a six-year-old boy who is brought into the emergency department where Lucy, an emergency medicine doctor, is working a night shift. And he comes in covered with blood and not speaking. He's brought in from a crime scene. And when she can finally get a word out of him, he says that his name is Leo.
Okay, so there's a clear element of mystery and confusion right at the beginning that takes us into this deeper question of sort of who are we and how have our memories shaped us and many themes that you play out during the course of the novel. So tell me a little bit about Lucy, the ER doctor, and then I'm going to have you read from her perspective for us.
Okay. Well, Lucy's near the end of her training as emergency medicine doctor, so she's probably at her peak, like, hardness. She's developed a real tough shell, a sort of a carapace to protect her from being affected too much by what she sees, and in order to keep herself effective as a doctor, she has to be pretty tough and kind of hard to get to. So she's a little bit more cynical than she would probably like to be.
She has a very hardened shell. Will you read a little bit of Lucy's section for us?
Sure. This is how we introduce Lucy, actually. Patients lie. Every doctor knows it. They lie innocently or out of embarrassment. They lie to get something they want, or to avoid something they fear. Good lies and bad lies, meaningless lies. There must be a limited number of lies in the world because I hear the same ones over and over again. I only had two beers. My car got broken into and my Vicodin was stolen. I was just walking down the street minding my own business and some dude came up and stabbed me. Some dude really gets around. He steals the pills, he stabs and shoots. He sails through red lights and stop signs and smacks into law-abiding cars. Sometimes he blooms cohorts. He has two dudes, or even three. I don't care about the lies or the dudes. I don't need or want the whole truth anymore. I want to know only the part that matters, that will guide me to discover what needs to be found and fixed.
That's author Lisa Schwartz reading from her novel, The Possible World. She'll be at Greensboro Central Library and at the Scuppernong Books in Greensboro at the end of August. So that line, she says, I want to know only the part that matters. That will guide me to discover what needs to be found and fixed. Tell me about her philosophy as an ER doctor at the beginning of this book and what you wanted to explore about that internal dialogue of an ER physician.
Yeah, I think she's realized during her training that the why is too big to grapple with. There is no explaining why things happen, why terrible things happen to nice people or bad people, why terrible things happen and people survive and terrible things happen and people don't survive, you know, why people do terrible things to each other. It just seems like a problem she can't even approach, and she's very interested in doing what she can and approaching what she can. So,
for you as a former ER doctor, how did you negotiate that to be both an objective observer of the situation as well as bring humanity to the job to the degree that is possible?
Oh, I think I had my period of being like Lucy where it was all about practicality. I mean, I decided that I wouldn't want a doctor who was weeping and sympathetic. I would want a doctor who was able to fix me. There are plenty of people to be sympathetic and weepy for you when you're having trouble. So I really was all about fixing and solving the problem. And then with time, you get better with the medicine. You understand it more and it becomes less center stage, and you can bring some humanity to the patient. So that did happen sort of after the training reached a critical point, which I'm glad to say I was able to, like, return to humanity and be a human with my patients.
So Lucy is just one of many perspectives in the book. There's also a woman named Claire. Tell us a little bit about Claire.
Oh, Claire. She's 99 years old. So she's about to turn 100. And she's living in a nursing home or care facility. She's actually really in good shape, as we would all wish to be. She's my dream, you know, nonagenarian. But she has lived a long life, and there is no one who has shared it with her this whole time. She has patches, and she's hidden most of it. At this point, people don't even look at her or think that she's got anything to tell them. But she does meet someone who does look at her like she's a person and has something to say, and she's inspired to tell her story, which she does in the book.
Will you read a section from Claire's voice?
Yes, this is before she's sort of woken to want to talk about her life. Nothing lasts. Though I lie here breathing, remembering, though I have existed and still exist, there's no proof of any of it. The years have poured through me. I am a vessel, nothing left of all I have known and felt, except a photograph I won't claim and this sediment of memory. Soon that too will be gone. And what after? No matter what the nuns promised, I fear that this is the only world there is. I'm aware of how generous my lifespan has already been, yet I'm galled at how ephemeral is all our suffering, all our loving and our hope. Nothing, nothing comes of it. Nothing that won't be snuffed out in an instant by death, leaving no trace. The nuns would be horrified at these thoughts, so would my mother. They would tell me hush. They would remind me of heaven's glory and of the miracle that saved me once upon a time. God has his reasons, they would say. There was a time when I would have believed this too, but that was a long time ago, and now I see it differently. To me, it seems more than possible that not all miracles come from God.
That's author Lisa Schwartz reading from her novel, The Possible World. She'll be at Greensboro's Central Library and at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro at the end of August. So we met Claire, who's going through some trauma in her marriage. Lucy is going through trauma in her marriage. We've now met Claire, who's had a variety of trauma throughout her life and now was reflecting back. And then at the beginning of the book, we met Ben, who's just suffered this trauma that we don't know a lot about. It seems to me that you're trying to look at, you know, what is it that makes a life story and how much do these traumas play a part in that and how much can we write a narrative that doesn't always include the trauma at the time. Tell me about your investigation into memory and trauma in this book and what you were trying to explore.
Well, I think the main thing I was trying to explore was I think we all suffer trauma. If we live long enough, it can be minimal, but we all suffer dislocations. We all have to say goodbye to loved ones and loved things. And with luck, you know, our lives are joyful and the trauma is outweighed by the joy. But if there is a significant trauma that's kind of cuts across your life, how do you sort of stagger away from that upright? And also, how much does it define you? And how much is there a core of you that is continuous before and after the trauma? Or are you completely changed? So that was one of the things I was interested in. And I was also interested in exploring, and I think this whole book, is the premise of this whole book is that nobody is just what they seem on the outside. So you have an old woman who's just an old woman, but she's really not. And you have a little boy who seems to be just a little boy, but he's really not just a little boy. And any parents out there understand what I mean. Their children are not just a little person, a little child. They're special. They're important. And Lucy, she herself is more than she thinks she is, although she doesn't really know it at the beginning of the book.
So these traumatic moments that become defining points in our lives and may take our life in a different direction sometimes can cause so much pain that they sort of reconstruct everything that's happened before. And I think you look at that a little bit through the perspective of Ben and ask this question, how much is some pain that's so deep worth remembering? And is it always important to exactly reconstruct painful memories? Can you tell me about your exploration into that and how that fits into maybe what you had to do as a physician investigating people's past traumas?
Sure. I think that there are probably many schools of thought about how important it is to remember the actual details of a trauma, I think that there's long been a school of thought that you should go over it and over it in therapy and understand it completely and really talk it through. But lately, there's actually been a movement to discuss it once in full detail and then leave it behind. And I think healing, they're finding that healing seems to be more complete. I don't think there's ever perfect healing. If you acknowledge every detail and then you leave it so that you're not dwelling on it over and over. And I didn't encounter that during my practice. I just, you know, read about that, you know, in the last few years. But in my practice, I certainly saw people who didn't have perfect grasp of what had happened to them. And I wondered if they really needed to. Do they really need to remember? You know, you'd see somebody whose brother had died in the car seat next to him, and you'd see the driver who'd survived. And, you know, does he need to remember seeing his brother die? Does he need that? Is that a memory that is going to help him in his life? I don't think so. But it may differ for different people.
It seems like Lucy, the ER doctor, really goes on that journey throughout the book of thinking, you know, at the beginning, she's this hardened medical professional who details are everything. Details are, you know, what allows her to do her job. But as she goes through the course of the book, she seems to come to a different understanding of the importance of trauma and the role it plays in our lives. For you in writing Lucy, I know you didn't identify with her as much as you identified with Claire. Can you talk a little bit about sort of how you come out in the characters in this book?
Sure. I think I've always been Claire, and I think I was Lucy for a part of my life, because Lucy is tough and she's very focused, like a bullet, to do what she needs to do. And I think, you know, I have that in me, but Claire is a bit of a curmudgeon. She's very steeped in her habits. She sees the world with a little bit of a wry humor. I mean, I was really fond of Claire, and it was easy to write her. Although she's 100, I felt, you know, maybe I have an inner 100-year-old, because I really felt very comfortable speaking in her voice. I read a lot of literature from the 19th century when I was little. I grew up reading some, you know, old books. And so I have these, you know, phrases in the back of my head. So I felt like I could bring out Claire.
And there, it's so clear to me in reading this that the book is told from three different perspectives. And it's very clear to me when the voice shifts, other than just, you know, seeing Leo or Claire. The way that you embodied each of them, you know, when I'm reading the chapters that are from Leo's point of view, the little kid, it feels like you're seeing the world through the eyes of a little kid. Everything is very sensory. Images are bright. He notices colors. And then it feels like Claire, the older woman, there's so much of a, like, she's recounting what's happening in real time as well. It's reflecting on how this intersects with things that have happened in her past. And then Claire's world is so inside baseball of, I'm sorry, Lucy's world is so inside baseball of being a doctor. And I felt like I could really see how you got into each person's perspective. Was that a challenge to write a book from three different, very different perspectives?
It really was. And I'm so glad to hear you say that you felt the voices were really distinct, because I wanted them to be, obviously. And I think it took a while. It was during the writing of it that I could settle into the characters and really see them sort of through their eyes. And that part became effortless after a while, because I really did see, you know, the little boy really does see the world through the eyes of a little boy. Everything is new, although there are some strange echoes that he doesn't really understand. And then Lucy, she really sees the details she needs to see, and she needs to see a lot of details. And Claire, everything reminds her of her long life, but
yeah.
She also, if you notice, there's not a lot of smell sensory detail in Claire. There's a couple of times she mentions smell, but not too often. It's only when it's really overwhelming, because that's a sense that kind of disappears or can become muted over time with age.
Hmm.
So Claire was more lost in her memories more than taking in new visual detail or sensory detail.
Talk about your process of working with an editor on this book. I know that you were instructed to do some tasks that seem difficult for a writer who's just poured their life into creating a novel.
Yeah, you know, I was so lucky to have Kara Watson and Nan Graham edited this book. And the lightness of the hand was, I had never had an editor before. My first editor was very of my first book was very big picture, and so there was never any actual discussing of words or phrases. And Kara would make, I would get back the hard copy. They would send me these hard copies, and there would be 20 pages, and then there would be like a squiggly line under one word. And I would think, and without a comment, I'd think, but that squiggly line said everything. It told me, this snagged me. And then I realized, okay, it snagged you because of a million things that are wrong with it. And it was beautiful. It was like lifting out. It's kind of like the little Jack Horner, you know, pulls out a plum from the pie. You know, you put it and there's this little problem, and it pulled out a huge number of problems that then I would solve. And sometimes a little squiggly line would cause a major rewrite. But at the end, when labor and finally this thing was in shape, and Nan said, you need to cut every extraneous word. And she said, you know, you need to do a major trim. And of course, I thought, well, every word needs to be there. But then I thought, well, I've loved every book Nan Graham has ever edited. So I went through and I found that she was right. You could take out a lot of words and scenes. And I think I mentioned to someone, I've used this before, it was like literary Jenga, where you're taking out as much as you can and seeing what will hold the shape. And then I apparently cut so ruthlessly that they actually put some back, which was wonderful for me because it made me feel like, oh, okay, I did enough. But I feel really good about how streamlined the book is. Although I like a book that will wander and meander in places, I really loved the way that this came out. So a straight shot, there really isn't any resting in the book.
One of the recurring phrases that Lucy comes back to throughout the book is, no matter how much you love medicine, it won't love you back. Did you fall out of love with medicine? Did you fall in love with writing? How does your relationship with the two sit at this point in your life?
Well, I think I was in love with writing since I was three. When I started, I wrote my first book at three, The History of the Universe. Not that I did not lack hubris, but I always knew I would write. That was something I knew I wanted to do, but I didn't really think I had anything to say. And I felt a need to do good. And medicine seemed really interesting and seemed like a powerful way to do good no matter where you ended up in the world, because I didn't want to be tied down to one place. And I found medicine was a tough thing to love, but I did love it. I really did love it. And I think that aphorism, which I heard in medical school, it did mean one thing to me in medical school, and then it meant something later. But if, you know, you have to love it because you can't expect it to give back to you. It's almost like, I'm not a mother, but I think people who have children, they love their children and they don't expect them to be perfect and disciplined. And, you know, it's not a conditional thing. You have to love medicine unconditionally because it will not necessarily always please you or make your life happy.
Does writing love you back?
I don't know, but I love it so much, I don't care.
Well, you do it wonderfully. My guest Thank is Lisa you. Schwartz. She's the author of The Possible World. She'll be at Greensboro Central Library and at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro at the end of August. You can find out details about those events at our website, stateofthings.org. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so nice.
Just ahead, the music of R&B artist Tracy Crews. Stay with us.